Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. The East Lansing City Council last night approved a city domestic partnership registry by a 4-0 vote. You've heard us talking about this a few times on Current State. Same-sex couples will be registered at the city clerk's office, just like heterosexual married couples. And arguably the bigger story today, many supporters of same-sex marriage are awaiting Judge Friedman's ruling, expected today, that could strike down Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. In East Lansing, the ordinance launching the domestic partnership registry becomes effective a week from today. Coming up later on our program today, why are there not more women pursuing the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math? We'll talk with a couple of distinguished women in the field of engineering and science who have some thoughts on that. Also coming up, the challenges facing the Lansing School District's aging buildings, school buildings, and other real estate, other property that it owns. There are dozens of properties in the district that have become increasingly in rough shape in recent years. We'll talk with the latest effort to try to get a handle on that. Talk with Sam Sinacropi, who's leading that effort, one of the leaders of that effort. At the top of the program, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has tapped the state's top financial and insurance regulator to become its next treasurer. Kevin Clinton assumes his new position on November 1st. Until then, Commissioner Clinton will work alongside outgoing Treasurer Andy Dillon, who announced his resignation last week. Mr. Clinton becomes responsible for overseeing the collection and management of billions of dollars in state funds and the financial health of its cities and school districts, most notably the city of Detroit. We welcome Kevin Clinton back to Current State.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Thanks for joining us, Kevin. We appreciate it a lot. What do you expect will be the focus of your energies, at least in the opening weeks at your new position?
Well, I think initially I'm going to go meet with legislators. I'm going to go meet with people over the Treasury, find out what the issues are, get caught up to speed on them. And I'm going to be meeting a lot with Andy Dillon, especially in the next 2 weeks. We have a transition period there. And I met with him yesterday, and I'm looking forward to meeting with him over the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Free Press reported that you said yesterday you want to work on a financial model that could help avoid the need for emergency managers in Michigan. Can you flesh that out any more for us?
Yes, if we can spot financial problems ahead of time, so we're not just walking into a municipality or school district and saying, hey, you guys have financial problems, we're going to name an emergency manager. If we can predict this maybe 5 years out or even longer, then the municipalities can take the steps necessary to maybe to shore up their finances, so there's no need to put an emergency manager in.
Hmm. How much work is involved in that longer range model?
Well, quite a bit. I mean, this will be a complicated model that can be put together by actuaries, and there may be some off the shelf products on there that I just don't know about yet. But we're going to look at that. I'd rather do it ahead of time and take the steps necessary to stop it from occurring than having to go in there. That's disrupting to the city. It's disrupting to the citizens.
Some key legislative leaders, including Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, appear to be quite receptive to your appointment, but I notice one legislator issued a very pointed call for change. Again, the Free Press quoted Senator Jack Brandenburg of Harrison Township, who claimed that Treasury has become, quote, polarized and dysfunctional in my book. They do nothing but terrorize small business people. They have 1,300 to 1,400 employees who have been doing things their way for the last couple of decades, and that has to change now. What do you make of the senator's comments?
Well, I read exactly what you read this morning, and I gave him a call, and I have a meeting set up with him this afternoon. So I'll find out what's on his mind.
I mean, are you aware enough of the operations of the Treasury Department to think that he has a point, though?
I've been given updates, and I'm gonna. I really want, before I comment on that, I really want to find out from the senator exactly what his issues are.
Okay.
And I'm meeting with other people on the tax committees.
You're taking over as treasurer on the eve of a possible national debt default. And as we enter the third week of a partial federal government shutdown, do you have a sense of how this could affect Michigan in the near future if this continues?
Well, I'm just concerned, you know, because we have worked as a state. You know, the governor and John Nixon have worked very hard to get our bond ratings up, and they have. We've gone from a stable condition to a positive outlook, which means we pay lower interest rates. You know, the higher your rating is, the lower interest rates you have to pay because we're considered more secure. So they've done a wonderful job, and I would just hate a federal shutdown to in any way harm that.
We are talking with incoming State Treasurer Kevin Clinton this morning on Current State. Putting on your insurance commissioner's hat for just a minute, where are we with auto no-fault insurance reform? Do you expect a bill to be put forth in the foreseeable future?
I'm very hopeful. The Speaker has gotten interested in this. I think it's on the governor's top list. We are talking to, you know, the providers, the hospitals, and the doctors who are affected by this, and I'm very hopeful we can get something on the board there.
Now, will your departure as director of the Department of Insurance and Financial Services affect that process?
I don't think so. First of all, I am available to come and assist at any time, despite my new position. But our new director, Ann Flood, is fully up to speed. She's been here 2.5 years, and she certainly can take the torch and run with it.
Are you excited about this challenge?
Yes, I enjoy challenges.
Okay. In a study released a couple days ago, the nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan suggests the state could lower auto insurance premiums without major changes to the no-fault system. The study cited factors like the auto insurance industry's inability to negotiate lower medical payments or implement cost controls, as well as shifting the primary responsibility onto health insurance providers. What's your take on that study's findings?
I first of all, I agree with most of the results of that finding, which is the citizens of Michigan, when we pay, you know, the medical bills due to an auto accident, you're paying way more than you need to. If you get your Blue Cross bill, for instance, and you're using a health insurance, you see maybe a charge from your doctor, $100, a discount of $60, and then you pay, or the Blue Cross paid $40, and you owe nothing. Well, they get a 60% discount off what they call the charge master file, the sticker price. They get a big discount. Auto insurers don't get that. So you're paying full freight. You're paying full sticker price if you're on the auto. I'll give you an example. I had a friend who was hit by a car. He was riding his bike. So his bill was paid for by his health insurer, and the bill amounted to about $8,300. Now, this is a person that walked into the emergency room and walked out. It was $8,300. So we took his bill with his permission and gave it to the auto carrier that he has and said, how much would you have paid on this? And they had all the codes, and it was over $19,000. So it's significant. And I equate this to, but, and when I said I agree with most of it, I still think we need additional changes in this. I think we need, you know, limits on attendant care. I think we need some fraud package bills. And I think we need some limits, because I equate this to, you know, if an individual hires a landscaper to come into their house and they say, you know, we want, why don't you fix my house, do some landscaping? You can charge me twice as much as you charge your other clients. You can determine what needs to be done, and I don't have a budget. You know, you'd pay a phenomenal amount. Nobody would do that with their personal finances, but with auto, that's kind of what it is. We don't have a limit. The doctor determines how much care has to be taken care of, and they charge twice as much as they do the health insurers.
What would a sensible limit on a claim be?
Well, right now, if you're you have medical bills, everybody's being required to or pay a penalty by health insurance effective January 1st with no pre-existing condition and no limits. So why not have your health insurance cover the majority of it, especially when these health insurers are getting much larger discounts than the auto insurers can?
Tell us about your successor at Insurance and Financial Services.
Well, I think we've had some great successes. I think number one is we negotiated. We were primarily the negotiator on the Blue Cross bill, and this is going to be good for citizens of the state. They are now going to be a mutual company instead of a creation of statute. they're going to contribute over the next 20 years not only $1.5 billion toward health and wellness fund in the state of Michigan, but probably roughly $3 billion in additional taxes to municipalities and the state that they're tax exempt from right now. So I think that's a positive for Michiganders. I think they're going to compete and create jobs. The other thing, I think the Affordable Care Act, I think we have done as much as we can on that moving forward. And we've been very successful where the federal government has not. We have a federal exchange here, but our department does quite a bit in assisting consumers, helping them understand. We have a rate calculator that you can go to and determine what your rates are going to be, or give you a range of what your rates can be. Unfortunately, the federal government website is not working very well right now.
Actually, what I meant by that question was your successor. Tell us a little bit. that was still really informative. I appreciate the information, but tell us a little bit about Ann Flood.
She has been chief deputy here for about 2.5 years. She comes with about 25 years of insurance experience. She has been chief operating officer at a couple of different companies. She is not only an attorney, but she's a registered nurse, which I think gives a real good background, not only the legal side, but the medical side of health insurance. So she comes with a great deal of, good education. She comes with a lot of experience in the industry and comes with experience in regulation. So I think a very good choice.
Very good. Kevin Clinton, congratulations on your new appointment. We appreciate making yourself available here on the first morning after this announcement, and we wish you the best of luck.
Great. Thank you very much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. This fall, Michigan State University's College of Engineering enrolled some 1,300 freshmen into its ranks, the largest incoming class in a decade. More than 200 of those students are women, and that number is up 30% over last fall. That's an encouraging sign for the industry as a whole. Nationwide, far more men enter the STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, than women. Now, a conference is taking place this week here at MSU that's seeking to address this shortage and other issues facing women in the industry. We are now joined by Dr. Laura Dillon, Professor of Computer Science and Engineering with the College of Engineering at MSU. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Ann Fisher. She's an advisory scientist at Strategic Analysis, Inc. in Washington, D.C. She's a chemist who's worked with the defense industry on projects pertaining to portable power and energy and nanomaterials, to name a few. She's also an MSU alumnus and is on the steering committee for this week's conference. Welcome, Ann Fisher.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Why are there so many fewer women in the STEM fields? Laura Dillon?
Well, I think it's primarily a socialization issue, not... we've heard some notorious statements to the effect of ability gaps, and I think that certainly has proven not to be true, that it really, a lot of it is how, in the early years, how women are just, girls are just told that, this is too hard for you. You're either born with the gene or you're not born with the gene. To be able to do math and to succeed in math, and it's certainly, if you look at the data, that's not true. I mean, part of it is an issue of getting parents, getting students to realize that these are good professions, that there are you can learn math skills, you can learn computing skills through hard work, and that you can do things that are very socially good and relevant that are important for our society.
Dr. Ann Fisher, do you generally agree with Laura Dillon? And if so, did you experience, what kind of socialization did you go through?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that it's not an aptitude based issue. It differs, you know, the number of women differ in different fields of science and engineering, and I think a lot of it is the examples that kids up to, you know, young kids in elementary school and high school and then through the college years, the examples that they see in terms of what people like them are doing. And this, you know, this goes for women or anybody, any other group. And, you know, in my experience, I went to a small college. There were quite a few women faculty in the sciences. I was highly encouraged by my parents growing up. And so I think, you know, having those types of mentoring relationships with people and having that encouragement is really important for everybody, but especially for young girls as they're thinking about what kind of career path they want to go to. Because, you know, in the sciences, you have to start pretty early to get that foundation to move forward in the field, and that's a critical piece.
Laura Dillon, how are you encouraged or discouraged?
I had a high school teacher who singled me out, and I mean, I was in a very unique situation because I was living down in South America where I went to high school, and he singled me out, and he put me on the side, and he gave me books to read, and I had my high school last class in high school was a two-person class where we taught ourselves, another woman and I taught ourselves calculus. And, you know, so it was very unusual. But I then later experienced many discouraging situations at universities here. And but I was lucky enough to fall into a situation where I also had mentors. I mean, I think you get them on both sides, right? You get some people who are very encouraging and others who are just blatantly discouraging.
Give us a blatant example.
A blatant example would be, I won't name the name of the university because they probably wouldn't be very happy, but having the chair of the department tell me when I was applying to graduate school and was graduating from their undergraduate program with a 4.0 that the only possible way I could get in and hope to compete against these men from Wisconsin was if I were to, instead of applying for a PhD program, would go into the program that the training for community college professors. And so I got into the program through the back door and eventually did well enough that they admitted me to the PhD program. But originally I was told that I couldn't get in unless to the program even unless I went to this lesser degree program as opposed to trying to go after the PhD. And this was in math.
Laura, this month you attended an event in Minneapolis called the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. Grace Hopper was a rear admiral in the U.S. Navy and a pioneer in computer science. She helped create one of the world's first computers, the UNIVAC, back in the 1940s. She's been revered as a founding mother of computer science. We've got a clip here of Grace Hopper from 1986. She just retired from the Navy after 43 years. Here she is explaining a nanosecond to late night TV host David Letterman.
Well, I could give you a nanosecond.
Okay, now, like I don't even know what that is, Grace.
Well, you see, we started with milliseconds, thousandths of a second, and then we went to microseconds, millionths of a second, and now we talk about nanoseconds. That's a billionth of a second.
Mm-hmm. But
well, he told me billionth of a second, and I didn't know what on earth they were talking about.
Right.
Didn't make sense to me. So one day I called over to engineering, said, cut off a nanosecond, send it over to me. And so I've got a bundle of them here, and you can pick your color.
Oh, they come in color. See, I didn't realize that nanoseconds
colors.
Now, in the old days, you only had your
I
choice
want.
Of white or gray, I think. Now, Gracie, I understand that this is a visual.
That is the maximum distance that light or electricity can travel in a billionth of a second.
No faster, no farther.
And, when an admiral asks you why it takes a damn long to send a message by a satellite, you point out to him that between here and the satellite, there are a very large number of nanoseconds.
All of this is a way to pave the question for you, Laura. What perspectives on women in STEM did you hear at this year's Grace Hopper celebration?
Well, the the celebration was really all about looking at the various accomplishments that women have made in the field, and it's quite astounding. So there were different tracks for all the different constituencies. So the students, there were tracks where they could go and they could learn how to succeed in graduate school and why they would want to and what kinds of careers they could expect. There were tracks for professional women in computing to discuss, how they can continue to succeed and climb up the ladders in their fields. And there were also technical tracks that looked at, some of the issues that women have, not just women, but that computing has impacted society and the world. Mm-hmm. So it was very inspiring. And, there are companies all over. National companies can't come and recruit the students there, and so it was a very empowering conference for them to go to.
Dr. Ann Fisher, what are the larger societal implications, as far as you see them, if we keep recruiting fewer women into the STEM fields?
Well, I think that people talk about diversity in science and engineering and don't really understand why it's important. It's important to so that everyone who is interested in those fields is encouraged to go into them. But it's also based on life experience and background and point of view, and those vary depending on where people came from, who they are, whether they're men or women, or whatever category you might want to talk about. And I think that it affects ideas, it affects creativity, it affects innovation, and it allows for diversity in both who's doing the science and also what science is done and how different problems are addressed, different points of view are brought in for in terms of creativity and how people look at a problem.
Dr. Fisher, what was your MSU experience like?
I had a great experience at MSU. I was in the chemistry department at Michigan State on the floor in analytical chemistry. And if, we're talking about the percentage of women, we actually had quite a few women graduate students in the analytical side of chemistry. It varied by floor, which would be by, physical chemistry, organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry. The number of faculty... the number of women faculty at Michigan State was what's much lower, but we had a group called Women in Chemistry where we, it was sort of a networking opportunity. We did a lot of outreach. It was kind of a way to get people sort of aware of what issues you might face, both in terms of explicit and implicit bias. And by that, I mean, by implicit bias, I mean, people have ideas and things that they're sort of unconscious of, and they may affect how you interact with someone. So that whether or not someone's encouraged to be in science is based on potentially their view of what a scientist might look like, those sorts of things. So it was a great experience, both because of the university, but also because of the proactive way that we as graduate students kind of try to integrate ourselves in to the bigger picture.
Could I add to that?
Laura, please do.
Yeah. One of the predictions of code.org is that by the year 2020, there's going to be 1 million more jobs than in the computing area, at least, than there are going to be students produced.
Mm.
And so part of it, I think, is not just the diversity is really important, but part of it is even just a numbers issue. If you're neglecting over half your population to even get them interested
to fill these important jobs,
then you're not looking at half of your talent pool, right? But then I would agree also that it's not just a numbers issue. That teams that they've shown that teams that are gender balanced, and not just gender balanced, but all diverse teams do better, produce better. They produce better products. They tend to deliver stuff on time, under budget, much more effectively than these teams that don't have that same kind of diversity in them.
How many women are on the MSU Engineering School faculty right now?
I wish I knew that number, but it's not very high. Chemical engineering has always done better in the engineering field. Any of the bio focused engineering fields tend to do better in terms of getting women, and where you really see the numbers are really low are in mechanical engineering, computing engineering, electrical engineering.
After your comments just a minute ago, Dr. Ann Fisher, would you say MSU is arguably ahead of the curve here?
That's a really interesting question. It's hard for me to say because I didn't go to graduate school anywhere else. I think that in terms of being aware of the issues, there were definitely people at Michigan State that were aware of the issues. I know that Michigan State has an advance grant, which is a grant from the National Science Foundation to increase the representation of women in science and engineering academic careers. And I think that's probably helping. I don't know the details of that. Maybe Laura does. But, it depends really on the university. It depends on the department. People at Michigan State were definitely aware of the issues and willing to talk about them, which I think is a really important first step at the graduate student level I'm speaking of here.
And Laura, what do you hope this week's conference will accomplish?
I think the role modeling issue that Amy already talked to, the fact of, you know, because there are so few women, they don't see one another, they don't always bump into each other in their classes and see the other women professors that are around on campus. And mm-hmm. So I think just, you know, having them get together, it's a networking issue. It's a building, a community building and building a support group, seeing examples of successful women and finding out the paths that they pursued, what worked for them, how they, you know, made it through. So a lot of it is just kind of giving some good examples and having the young women look up and say, oh, yeah, I want to be like that person, and I can be like that person. Person had a balanced life. Most of us have husbands and children, and, you know, so one of the concerns, I think, sometimes with women is they can't have it all. And, well, no, I mean, you always make some sacrifices along the way, but you can still have a good, rich, satisfying home life and career life. And sometimes the having a good career life makes you better at home, right?
Ann Fisher, how do you feel about being back in East Lansing and participating in this conference?
Well, actually, unfortunately, I'm not able to make it back for the conference this year. But
I misunderstood.
No, that's fine. I was on the steering committee to help put the conference together, and I'm really sad that I'm going to be missing it because it looks like they've put together a really great schedule that includes, you know, sessions on networking and mentoring and communication. And I completely agree with Laura, having that connection both in terms of professionals at the same sort of career maturity level and also in between with students and faculty and students and people from the private sector is really very, very important.
We want to thank our two guests this morning, Dr. Laura Dillon, Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the College of Engineering here at Michigan State, and Dr. Ann Fisher, an MSU alumnus who's an advisory scientist at Strategic Analysis, Inc. in Washington, D.C., talking about women in the STEM fields. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Good
thank
luck.
You.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. The Lansing School District is again trying to figure out what to do with dozens of aging buildings. Last week, an 11-member citizen panel began meeting to come up with recommendations on how to proceed with leaking roofs, hobbled heating systems, and the like. But the administration wants the new Facilities Task Force to consider what's best for the district decades into the future. We're going to learn a little bit more about the challenges ahead. Sam Sinicropi is a co-chair of the Facilities Task Force and the former Associate Superintendent of Facilities for Lansing Schools. Welcome to Current State, Sam.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm really well. Glad you're here. Can you describe for us the kinds of challenges the district faces in these older buildings? What are the most common problems?
Well, one of the things that we've noticed over the years is that education has changed in the respect of the types of equipment you need, the technology involved in it, and many of our buildings, it makes it difficult to retrofit those buildings as we look into the future.
But what about, I mean, I know leaking roofs have been a problem in the past. A lot of the boilers that need to keep the buildings warm in the wintertime, those have been issues as well. There are infrastructure problems, more basic infrastructure problems as well.
Absolutely. Several years ago, the citizens of the Lansing School District passed a sinking fund millage, which helped us address some of those things. But there are many other issues that we are unable to look at, mainly because of lack of funds.
Mm-hmm.
And the sinking fund helps, but there's still more is needed.
How many buildings does the district need to maintain? It's in the dozens, correct?
Correct. We have 17 elementary buildings, 720, about 30 buildings altogether, but that's more than just school buildings. We have the administration building and transportation center and things like that.
And how many of those 30 or so buildings need work?
I would say probably all of them, with the exception of maybe Pattengill, because as buildings get, we have buildings that range from built in 1926 and to 1976 is the earliest before Pattengill was built.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of maintenance and maintaining of stuff that needs to be accomplished each year.
How much would all of the necessary work cost? Do you have an idea?
We estimate, and this is a very rough estimate, that we're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars if we were going to bring things all into the 21st century, which is why this facilities committee is looking very closely at each building to see what should be done, what it needs to look like for the future, and is it a viable place for us to have it educate kids.
Now, you've got a perspective on this problem that a lot of people don't have, because when you were an associate superintendent with the district for all those years, you were facilities were your charge. What kind of options have you supported in the past in this environment of too little revenue? What are your options when revenue is such a challenge?
Well, it's a balancing act, and what we have done in past years is that we try to prioritize the needs of all the buildings. For instance, I'm going to go back to the sinking fund for a bit, and with that we've been able to replace roofs and boilers and parking lots, windows, lighting, the basic types of things. We also have a technology portion of that. So as we look at the basic infrastructure, we also need to look to the future for the technology needs of our students in the next 20 or 30 years.
Did you support the idea of a new high school a few years ago? I know that was one of the topics on the table. Mm-hmm. To help address Sexton High School and Eastern High School, which are both pretty old buildings.
Did I support it? I certainly concurred with the recommendations from Mayor Hollister's committee at the time. And I'm speaking as someone who has spent most of my life in Lansing, graduated from a high school in Lansing. My kids graduated from high schools in Lansing. I look around at the surrounding areas in the county and out county where we have new high schools built and new facilities. And I'm a strong believer that our kids in the Lansing School District deserve new facilities also.
There have been bold proposals as to what to do in the past, the Hollister-led commission probably most recently. What does your group need to do to be successful?
Well, one of the things that we listed, we had our first meeting last Wednesday,
right?
And we listed what we would like to accomplish from all this. And one of the things, and we listed how we're going to get to those get to a conclusion. And one of the ways is that we need to look at the past. There's several reports and committees that have met in the past several years. We need to look at what those conclusions were and what their recommendations were. We're going to what I would like the committee to do, and we're co-chaired by Kelly Dean of Dean Transportation, is we want to take people to buildings and we want to say, okay, here's what we're talking about right here. We also would like to look at some new high schools that have been built.
Who would you take to the buildings?
Our committee, excuse me.
Okay,
Members of the committee, because we have talked about, for lack of a better term, field trips, you know, to look at where we need, what possibilities are.
Now, the State Journal opined in its editorial yesterday that previous Board of Education members, and I'll quote here, have demonstrated rather thin skins when it comes to making difficult decisions about closing school buildings. Any truth to that in your view?
I would respond in the following, in that when you talk about closing buildings, it's a very emotional experience.
There's
for lots of
great deal of resistance to change, right?
Very emotional, very attached to their building. I think that being a school board member, you have a lot of difficult decisions to make. And as we go through our process, and we hope to present some recommendations in December, we're going to fast track this, and then the decision will have to be made. And I believe that the time is probably right now for those changes to be accepted.
The district has endured financial struggles for a number of years. Last spring, it had to make the no doubt difficult decision to lay off all the certified arts, music, and phys ed teachers from the elementary schools. Once again, facing such limited resources, what do you make of how the district prioritizes where the greatest needs are? What if you have a triage formula? For example, is restoring arts and music education, or is it fixing decaying facilities?
You've sort of hit the nail on the head, and I have a lot of faith in our superintendent and our current Board of Education to be able to look at those priorities and make good decisions for the students and the citizens of Lansing. I don't know all the answers, and you posed some interesting questions. What do we do first? Do we take care of instruction? Do we take care of the infrastructure? There, it's got to be both altogether.
Mm-hmm. When you talk to families with kids in the district, how do they tend to feel? Are they more eager to preserve what exists, or would they generally prefer a new high school or new buildings?
I think it's mixed, you know, a mixed response, and it depends on what I've noticed in talking to people, especially in the last year or so, is that there is some excitement about having a pre-K-3 buildings. That seems to get people excited to have their students in that environment. And I think that's what we need to do as a school district and as a community. How do we retain the kids we have, and how do we draw new students into this district?
Do you need to raise awareness amongst the families who send their kids to Lansing schools? I mean, are they as aware of the structural challenges that these buildings have as they should be?
I think people are aware of it, but I think as a parent who had kids in school and working with parents all my life in this area, parents are concerned about the education their kids received and are we preparing kids for the future. They're concerned that we have the infrastructure, as we've talked about before, for technology and the things that will prepare kids for what's going to happen in the future, for things that we may not even know what that is right now, mm-hmm. but we need to be ready for it.
When will the panel issue its recommendations?
We hope to have the recommendations issued at the end of December.
Is that enough time?
I think so.
Okay. And how many more times do you expect to meet? You want these field trips, so to speak. You want those to be a part of your
right.
activities.
I would guess we have our second meeting is scheduled for next week, and we probably will meet every 2 weeks through December, through the 1st of December.
And you're sharing the leadership responsibilities with Kelly Dean of Dean Transportation.
Correct. Okay.
Where can you speak on Kelly's behalf as to, you know, what particular views he may have on how to move forward with this? He was unable to join us here this morning, so I'm asking you to speak on his behalf. But
well, I guess I'm speaking on behalf of the committee, and he's the co-chair of the committee, and
right.
I think there's a great deal of interest, and I want to emphasize one other thing is there's no decisions that have been made. We're not going in and say, okay, we need to do this or we need to do that, but here are the facts. We need to come up with some decisions. Kelly has been a longtime supporter of not only the Lansing school districts, but many mid-Michigan school districts, and I probably would not speak for him if to answer your question.
Okay. I can respect that. Well, Sam Sinacropi is a co-chair of the Facilities Task Force. He's the former Associate Superintendent of Facilities for Lansing Schools. Got a lot of work on your plate here, even as a recently retired guy. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
You're welcome.
Good luck. Being Wednesday here on WKAR's Current State, it's the day we take a look at an organization in the Lansing area doing good things. It's our Neighbors in Action segment, and today we take a look at a group called One Love Global. Our guest is the president and CEO of that group, Angela Waters Austin. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you.
Tell us about what One Love Global's mission is.
Our mission is really to transform communities by working with people and organizations and systems to make those transformations. Our focus is peace, justice, and opportunity, and making sure that all children have an opportunity to succeed.
Do you focus on young people then? Would you say that's a particular focus?
It is absolutely a particular focus.
Yeah. Tell us about some of your projects. You're working on a number of issues, including early childhood education, I know.
Yes. In fact, we began focusing on ages 14 to 24, and then we extended that to age 12. And over the last 2 years, through our work with so many wonderful people in the community, the Ingham Great Start Collaborative and the Great Start Family Coalition and the Health Department and Michigan State University, is Capital Region Community Foundation. I want to shout out all of these wonderful partners, United Way, because we worked really hard for many years to actually pull together this initiative around early childhood equity.
Okay. Yeah, the focus has gotten younger and younger,
absolutely,
it would appear, but an awful lot of people appear to be on board with that. Your group has also, it also started the Lansing Hip Hop Festival. How did you move in that direction?
We moved in that direction because the community, it was just present in the community. We just really observed through social media primarily, and that was really how the festival began. We just really saw this really rich kind of subculture in the community and recognized that there is an untapped economy within our region that is really driven by young people. And it's a global marketplace. And we have talented young people who have connections all over the country with major labels and that perform all over. And I thought, you know, we need to showcase this and actually begin to bring something to this community that crosses ages, that crosses generations, cultures, because it is so diverse. There is not one typical hip-hop fan.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is the focus of your energies here? I mean, you've mentioned education. You've got a cultural piece going on here with the hip-hop festival. Where do you spend the majority of your energy?
I would say it's fairly balanced between working at the direct level with building leadership among youth and families. We actually have a youth leadership organization called Peace and Prosperity Youth Action Movement, and they have their own issues agenda. They're focused on policy and environmental change. And we also work with and support a family organization called NEON, and they focus on early childhood. And that's a group of parents that have come together to transform systems in their communities, and their focus is on third grade reading levels. So we really focus on three pillars: leadership, education, and entrepreneurship.
What I'll ask you a question that I asked a couple of city council candidates here yesterday. If you could succeed at one particular challenge facing the city of Lansing, which challenge would you like to succeed at? Would it be the educational piece? Would it be culture? What would it be?
Well, you know, that's interesting because there's not one silver bullet. I think what I would love to win in is having a highly coordinated, highly collaborative system from ages 0 to 25, really building a P-20 model that supports our students from birth, supports families even before conception so that they're prepared to be parents, but that we're breaking the cycle of poverty and trauma by bringing together all the partners towards one common goal. If we could get people moving in one direction, focus on making sure all children succeed, that would be a win for me.
You mentioned a large number of collaborators, other organizations that you work with. Give us a couple that you work with most closely.
Most closely, I work with the Ingham Change Initiative. One Love Global in itself is a social enterprise. What we do is we partner through contracts with major partners who are able to bring in vast resources that, as a small nonprofit, we really aren't able to compete for. But what we do is we come and we support these larger initiatives, and we specialize in bringing together partners across sectors, across systems. So we bring together grassroots community, we work with faith organizations, as well as our institutional and business leaders, because we have to have all hands on deck if we really want to see this kind of change.
How long has One Love Global been around?
We actually will celebrate our 10th anniversary January 14th, 2014. We spent the first 5 years just simply as a think tank. We went into deep research, deep planning, really just trying to answer one question. For those of us in Detroit who grew up on the Schoolcraft, Southfield corridor, how is it that we were successful when so many of our peers were not? And we really just brainstormed and researched what was working, not just in America, but around the world. And we infused everything that we learned when we launched here in Lansing. In 2008, we filed our 501c3, and actually it was expedited by the IRS because they love the model.
Hmm. And you have a chapter in Rwanda? Is that
correct? We do. We have partners. It's called the Rwanda Youth Initiative. And thanks to MSU's International Agriculture Department, we actually are able to communicate with a wonderful group of young people there who are cultivating mushrooms. We're still raising money to get the first 10 plots going, but we've been working on it. We have a fundraiser coming up in December.
And did MSU make that connection possible then, or how did that collaboration unfold?
Well, we are in deep partnership with MSU on so many levels. We work really closely with the team at University Outreach and Engagement on multiple projects. And because of that relationship, I'd actually been in communication with the group in Rwanda for a couple of years and really looking for a way to kind of bring it together. And it was through MSU that we were able actually to bring it together, because we had been trying to pull it together through social media with very limited resources. And MSU basically said, you know, we have all this technology over here, we can make this happen. And so we brought the youth leaders over. And so they've been communicating on a monthly basis with the youth in Rwanda to plan this project.
We're talking with Angela Waters Austin, President and CEO of the Lansing Group One Love Global, here on our Neighbors in Action segment here on Current State. Where does your funding come from?
We earn it. We are a social enterprise. So the Lansing Early Childhood Equity Project, we are actually contracted to coordinate that project and bring the partners together, do the planning, work with the evaluation team. When we're actually going deeply into working on structural racism within the early childhood system, and we'll be working with some of our really top early childhood experts in the community to look at some of the underlying issues and root causes and work on those at least for the next 6 months, and hopefully a longer term to begin to address some of those issues.
Now, do you recruit volunteers? If people want to get involved with your work, how can they do that? And what are some of the opportunities where they can help if you're looking for volunteers?
We are always looking for volunteers because we do a number of events. One of the ways that we engage the community is through a series of events, multiple, like the Hip Hop Festival. We have other events. We have a Power of Nine edutainment series that's focused on youth, where youth put on events for other youth. And we always need adult supports for that, because what we do is we invite community partners around different themes so that youth can be connected to other organizations and the resources that they have in the community. So the theme may be HIV and AIDS, and we'll bring in the community partners that actually have the resources so that youth can find out about them. We'll bring in higher education partners so they can get those resources. We do fashion shows through a new initiative that we have called Style Michigan that is connecting youth to Michigan's growing garment industry. So we just try to stay on the cutting edge of what's relevant to youth, we actually let them tell us what they need. We really are driven by youth. As adults, we have 15% of the power, and the youth have the other 85%, and they really set the agenda for what we do.
The 85% of the energy, I would say.
Yes, definitely.
I hesitate to ask this question, because it sounds like you have plenty of initiatives going on. But if you could add another one, is there another one that you would love to get involved in, or that you're planning to get involved in?
Well, the one that's really on the cusp right now, that's really, I think, exciting to so many people, and I'm sharing this excitement, well, hopefully with the entire region, is a partnership with New World Flood and Todd T.J. Duckett, who really excels in volunteer recruitment management. He manages to bring together so many people and take really cool innovations and actually bring them to scale. And so the nature of our partnership is to actually come together to provide backbone support for a new coalition that's forming to focus on children ages 0 to 25. So I think my dream is actually much closer to coming true through this partnership.
The Duckett brothers are a couple of guys you want in your corner. I think
Absolutely.
That's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Angela Waters Austin is CEO and president of Lansing's One Love Global. Fascinating hearing about your group. Angela, best of luck, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We could always use more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment on Current State. We know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just don't know about them. So please help us out. Send us an email about these great nonprofits in the area to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. That's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll track the issue of gay marriage in Michigan. The state's ban could be overturned as soon as today. We'll speak with Lansing's two newest inductees to the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Johnny Mathis joins us tomorrow as well. All of that and more on tomorrow's show. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. And thank you to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.